Shalom Hanavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the book of Isaiah. We're in session number 19, and we're working our way through the book of Isaiah using Ariel's exegetical outline notes as our foundation, notes provided and developed by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. All right, let's start our review of last session and the previous few sessions. We've been in a section dealing with the nations, the history of the nations that affect Israel. We looked at the history of Assyria and the history of Philistia, the history of Moab, Syria and Israel together, Ethiopia, Egypt. And when we looked at the history of Egypt in chapter 19, this was Egypt of the future, Egypt of the tribulation, Egypt of the second coming, and Egypt of the kingdom. So when we finished up that section, we reviewed the features of the Messianic kingdom that we learned about from chapter 19. First of all, feature number 24, that five cities in Egypt will speak Hebrew in chapter 19, verse 18. Feature number 25, Egypt will experience a national regeneration. And feature number 26, that there will be an economic, religious, and blessing union between Egypt, Israel, and Assyria. Then we return to the history of other nations. We looked at Egypt, but this was the Egypt and Ethiopian alliance that was smashed by the Assyrians. So this was back closer to Isaiah's time, a jump back in time. We reviewed the four Gentile empires that make up the times of the Gentiles, the four Gentile empires of Daniel. And Daniel chapter 2, the revelation was given focusing on the image of a man. The empire was Babylon, which was the head of gold, followed by Medo-Persia, the chest and arms of silver. Next was Greece, the belly and thighs of bronze. And finally, Rome. Rome was symbolized by the composite legs and feet of iron and clay. And then finally, the Messianic kingdom was symbolized by the rock that smashed the image and then grew to be a mountain that filled the whole earth. In Daniel 7, the revelation focused on four beasts. Babylon was the lion-like beast, Medo-Persia, bear-like, Greece, leopard-like, Rome, a composite beast, and then the kingdom was given to believers. In Daniel 8, the revelation focused on only two of these nations, the ram and the goat, Medo-Persia being the ram, and Greece being the male goat. Then we define the times of the Gentiles. According to Luke 21:24, the definition of the times of the Gentiles would read like this: Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And the duration then of the times of the Gentiles, it lasts from the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC by the Babylonians until the return of Yeshua. And so we're in the times of the Gentiles right now. And this duration, this the times of the Gentiles, does not preclude temporary Jewish control of Jerusalem, as during the Maccabean era. Jerusalem will be trampled down by the Gentiles, but there have been times of temporary Jewish control. The Maccabean era, the experience we're having now right in the year 2018. Then we looked at our timeline. We started with the dispensation of law, followed by the dispensation of grace. After the dispensation of grace, there's a 75-day interval, and then the dispensation of the kingdom occurs. The Messianic kingdom is set up. After the Messianic kingdom, there's an aftermath. We don't know exactly how long that lasts. And then we enter the eternal state. So that is our basic timeline for the Bible. All right, back to our map. We then looked at the history of the city of Babylon and the country of Babylonia, and then Edom, but this is Edom of the kingdom, and we summarize the history of Edom mentioned in Isaiah 21:11-12 and the related passages with information about Edom. And this is what we learned, that Edom will play a key role in the tribulation. A large segment of the Jewish community will be besieged in Edom by Antichrist during the second half of the tribulation. And this brought us to the fifth stage of the tribulation holocaust. The fifth stage of the campaign of Armageddon, I should say. The fifth stage of the campaign of Armageddon, which is the beginning of the Tribulation Holocaust and the Jewish flight to Basra. Jerusalem will fall to the Antichrist, and the survivors will flee south into the land of Edom, to Basra, or known also as Petra, to Basra in the land of Edom. Edom is then the initial place of the Second Coming. This brings us to the eighth stage of the campaign of Armageddon, at the Second Coming of the Messiah. So the Jewish community besieged in Basra will call out to Yeshua, begging him to return, and he will respond, he will return, and the initial point of the Second Coming will be Basra, where he rescues the Jewish people imprisoned in Basra, besieged in Basra. From Edom, Yeshua moves out to tread the winepress of God's wrath, destroying the Antichrist's armies and rescuing the Jews in Jerusalem. This is the ninth stage of the campaign of Armageddon. The Messiah treads the winepress. He leaves Basra and goes to Teman, and from Teman he will tread the winepress into the wilderness of Paran, and then northward through the Negev, destroying the armies of the Antichrist, and finally approaching Jerusalem from the south. The winepress of the wrath of God Almighty. Now, during the kingdom, Edom becomes a burning wasteland and the abode of demons. We've already learned that there are two burning wastelands in the Messianic kingdom, in Isaiah 14 and in Isaiah 34. And Edom, when we get to Isaiah 34, will be detailed as one of the burning wastelands. And, of course, we already looked in Isaiah 14, Babylon, the area of Babylon, will be another burning wasteland. While the rest of the world is beautified, these two places will be the prison houses of demons. And what features of the Messianic kingdom will we learn about in verse 21? Well, we learn that Edom will experience the silence of death. She will be a wasteland during the kingdom. Back to our study of the nations, we looked at the history of Arabia and the history of Judah and Jerusalem. Now, we're in the near future, and now we move into a time frame where the prophets present and the near future are so tightly woven together that it's difficult to separate them. So I just put them under one column there in verses 15 through 25. So in verses 15 through 25, we pick up the story of Shebna and Eliakim in Isaiah's immediate day. We have a short interlude about these two men. This is a short-term prophecy that validates Isaiah and also affirms the Assyrian devastation. So our interlude begins focusing in on Shebna. Shebna is the unfaithful steward in the kingdom. In verse 15, a commission is given to Isaiah. Thus says the Lord God of hosts, come, go to this steward, to Shebna, who is in charge of the royal household. Now, this is the only time that Isaiah prophesies against an individual. He prophesies against Shebna. Now, because of his office, Shebna had a very high office in the government. He supported and encouraged the self-security and forgetfulness of God that was rampant in Judah. It says he was over the house. Again, this is the highest office next to the king. Only the king is higher in authority than Shebna. And because of his lofty authority, he decided he would build himself a lofty tomb, something commensurate with his position. Verse 16. What right do you have here, and whom do you have here, that you've hewn a tomb for yourself here? You who hew a tomb on the height, you who carve a resting place for yourself in the rock. All right, Shebna was far more concerned about his own personal welfare than the kingdom's welfare. He was more concerned about his memory and his legacy. That's why he spent a lot of time, money, and effort to have this lofty and impressive tomb carved out of the rock for himself. But Shebna will go into exile because of his corruption. Verses 17 and 18. Behold, the Lord is about to hurl you headlong, O man, and he is about to grasp you firmly and roll you tightly like a ball to be cast into a vast country. There you will die, and there your splendid chariots will be, you shame of your master's house. What an evaluation of a life. He is the shame of his master's house. health, a house. So he's going to be wrapped up like a ball and thrown into exile. Of course, what was the picture that came to my mind of this happening to Shebna, but of a pitcher tossing a baseball away? The Lord, the pitcher there in the red would symbolize the Lord, and Shebna would be that little baseball that he is tossing into a far, far country. So he will die in a foreign country, and he'll never occupy this tomb that he lavished so much time, money, and concern on. And to die in a foreign country was a point of disgrace. And the reason for all this, his shameful misuse of his position. He was a shame to his master's house. So Shebna will be demoted in verse 19. I will depose you from your office, and I will pull you down from your station. Well, so much for the information about Shebna. Now we move to the second man involved in this interlude. The second man is Eliakim. Eliakim is the faithful steward. While Shebna was the unfaithful steward, Eliakim is the faithful steward. So Shebna will be replaced by Eliakim in verses 20 and 21. Then it will come about in that day that I will summon my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. And I will clothe him with your tunic and tie your sash securely about him. And I will entrust him with your authority. And he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. So Eliakim will prove to be a faithful and responsible steward. Now his authority is discussed in verse 22. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulders. When he opens, no one will shut, and when he shuts, no one will open. Now the power of the keys is a symbol of authority and responsibility. The keys to the kingdom, the keys to the royal chamber, consisted of supervision of the royal chambers themselves. So whoever has the keys decides who will or who will not enter to see the king. So it was a very important and powerful position. Now, Peter, this moves over into the New Testament for us, over into the Brit HaDashah, with Peter. Peter was given the keys to the kingdom of heaven. You know, Eliakim will be given the keys to the royal chambers. And that's a lot of authority. But Peter was given the keys to the kingdom of heaven in Matthew 16:19. To Peter, Yeshua says, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. Now, this didn't make Peter the Pope, but Peter was given the privilege and the authority to use the keys of the kingdom of heaven to open the gospel door to the Jewish community, to the Samaritans, and to the Gentiles. Whatever he opens was opened. Whatever he shuts is shut. So he opened the door to these three groups of people. Now, the key to the house of David is held by Yeshua these days, held by the Messiah, and we know that from Revelation 3:7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, He who is holy, He who is true, and of course that's a reference to Yeshua, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens, says this. So there's the all authority in heaven and earth has been granted to the Messiah, to Yeshua. He can open and shut whatever he wishes according to his will. Eliakim's glory is then discussed in verses 23 and 24. I will drive him like a peg in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. And so they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of vessels, from bowls to all the jars. Now, the illustration of Eliakim's glory is, I should say, a nail or a tent peg is used to illustrate Eliakim's glory. So in the future, he'll be like a nail fastened in a sure place, or like a tent peg. Well, what was happening here? Well, this tent peg or a nail was inserted into a hole in the large major tent pole in the center of a tent. And then all the valuables the family had were hung from that that tent peg in the center of the tent on the tent pole. Now, here is an illustration. This is the interior of a Bedouin tent. Now, you can see the major tent poles there in the middle of the room, just to the left of this lady. And what is hanging on those major tent poles right there? Those are the valuables of the house. Those are the valuable belongings of the household. And why are they there? Because that's the most secure place in the tent. If someone wanted to come in and rob the tent, rob the family at night, they would have to walk over the bodies of all the people sleeping around the tent poles. And so that's the most secure area. It's not likely they would succeed without waking somebody up and getting caught. So that's the most secure place in the tent, and so all the valuables are hung there. And so the scripture says, upon this nail, the house of Eliakim will hang its glory. So Eliakim will be valued by his household for his faithfulness and for his godly character. That will be his glory. In contrast, Shebna will fall. Verse 25. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, this is the day when Eliakim is raised up to his position over the household. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that the peg driven in a firm place will give way. It's a reference to Shebna. It will even break off and fall. The load hanging on it will be cut off, for the Lord has spoken. So Shebna was the current tent peg, and Shebna thought he was a nail in a sure place. He thought he was secure. He had a job security, the highest person in the kingdom next to the king. But this nail, Shebna's glory, will give way because of the weight of his own corruption. Now, Shebna's demise came in three steps. Step number one, it was predicted here in Isaiah 22, verses 17 through 19. Then it was realized in Isaiah 36 and 37. Isaiah 36:3 reads, then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household. So notice Eliakim is now in the top position in the kingdom, other than the king. And where is Shebna? And Shebna the scribe, he's been demoted to scribe. And Yoah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him. So that's the first indicator in Isaiah 36. Then in Isaiah 37, verse 2, then he sent Eliakim, who was over the household. There it's repeated. He is now in the top position in the kingdom, just below the king. And Shebna was Shebna the scribe, demoted to this lower position. And the elders of the priests, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz. So he has been demoted. Now, the demise of Shebna was finalized because he was captured and exiled by the Assyrians. So when the Assyrians came in, and they ravaged Judah, but Judah survived. Now, we don't know exactly how Shebna was captured and exiled. That we don't know. Rashi says that he was kidnapped by Sennacherib according to Jewish tradition. And this would be during the events of Isaiah 36 and 37. So that could be true. Anyway, Shebna met his demise. And you know, archaeologists have discovered evidence of Shebna. They've discovered evidence in two bulla. Now, what is a bulla? A bulla are clay seals impressed with a stamp used to secure a document. Now, here's a drawing of a papyrus document. And you see it's been written upon, then it's been rolled up. String has been wrapped around it in three places and tied in a knot. And then a little lump of clay has been pressed down on top of that knot. Then that lump of clay is stamped with a seal of some sort. Sometimes a ring that the person would wear, but a seal is then impressed into that clay. And that seal usually contains the name of the official who wrote the document or the person who was going through to whatever. But the document is then validated and sealed. And this document cannot be opened by an unauthorized person without breaking that seal. If the seal is broken, you know the document has been compromised. So that's the idea behind the bulla. And the plural is bulla. Now here are the two bulla that are related to Shebna. See, two clay bulla made with the same stamp have been discovered. Two different pieces of clay, but they've been stamped with the same stamp. And a comparison of the undamaged portions of these two bulla reveal the inscription, Shebna Yahu, the servant of the king. Shebnayahu, the servant of the king. And the archaeologists dated the tubule from the time of Hezekiah and Isaiah. That's the time when Shebna was in the kingdom. So apparently these tubule sealed two different documents written by Shebna, the very same Shebna mentioned in our text. So the discovery of these tubule confirms the truth of the Bible once again. The Bible tells us about real people and actual events that happened thousands of years ago. Isaiah, Hezekiah, Eliakim, and Shebna were real people who lived in approximately 700 BC, about 2,700 years ago. And these tubule provide proof of their reality. All right, let's take a minute or two to do an application, a drash, on Isaiah 21 and 22. The theme I chose is the contrast between Shebna and Eliakim. The biblical material taught us this. The biblical material showed us that Shebna was irresponsible, unfaithful, and only concerned with his own personal welfare. Therefore, he did not responsibly perform the job that was given to him. And because of his prestigious position, he influenced many to forget God. So God judged him by demoting and then exiling him. Eliakim, in contrast, was faithful to God until the responsibilities God gave him. God honored him, and his whole household reaped the benefit of his godly life. Now let's personalize this. Each of us personally, let's let each of us personally in our own hearts purpose to follow the example of godly Eliakim. In the job God has given us, whether it be as a homemaker, an employee, an employer, a parent, a grandparent, whatever, let us purpose to be responsible. Let us purpose to be faithful. Concern for others first. Let us purpose to influence others to seek God in their life. We have wonderful promises in Scripture about how God will prosper and bless those who prosper, who perform their work faithfully. Here in Isaiah 22, we have the example of God blessing faithful Eliakim. But we have other sections of Scripture with that great promise. Proverbs 17:2, a servant who acts wisely will rule over a son who acts shamefully and will share in the inheritance among brothers. So Eliakim would be the servant who acts wisely, and the son who acts shamefully would represent Shebna. And then we have Proverbs 27:18, he who tends the fig tree will eat its fruit. He who cares for his master will be honored. And it was Eliakim who cared for his master and cared for the kingdom. Shebna cared for himself. And Ephesians 6, 5 through 8 is a good application for all of us in the present time living under the brief Hadashah. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in the sincerity of your heart, as to Messiah. Not by way of eye service, as men pleasers, but as slaves of the Messiah, doing the will of God from the heart. With goodwill render service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. All right, let's all be an Eliakim and not a Shebna. All right, we need to move on now. We're back to our map. We're back to the history of these nations. And we now come to the history of Phoenicia and the city of Tyre. And this is our final nation and city that we examine. Now, we were in the prophet's present time. And now we move into a little more distant, into the near future, in chapter 23, verses 1 through 18. We're a little farther down the timeline than we were just a few minutes ago. All right, we are now looking at Tyre and the burden or the Masah that comes upon the prophet is revealed in the first part of verse 1. The oracle concerning Tyre. The burden concerning Tyre. This is what came to Isaiah. It's about devastation. And so the rest of the verse introduces the revelation. Wail, O ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is destroyed, without house or harbor. It is reported to them from the land of Cyprus. So the revelation begins with the wailing of the ships of Tarshish. Now, what are the ships of Tarshish? Well, these ships are trading ships. They're Phoenician ships that sailed the Mediterranean to Tarshish on economic missions. Now, here's a picture of a map of the Mediterranean Sea. Here is Tyre on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And clear across on the other side is Tarshish on the coast of Spain. And so the trading ships from Tyre would go back and forth along the Mediterranean Sea from Tarshish to Tyre and from Tyre back to Tarshish, carrying goods and produce. And this commerce benefited Tyre, and she was very, very strong and wealthy city. Tarshish was a trading colony of the Tyrrhenians, a trading colony of the Phoenicians. And so the ships of Tarshish, these trading ships of the Phoenicians, learned of Tyre's fall while they were anchored in Cyprus. Now, Cyprus, or Kittim, is this island located here on the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. They were apparently in a harbor there, anchored there in Cyprus, when they get the word of Tyre's devastation. Now, Tyre is to be destroyed, and other cities are going to be affected, other cities in the that were influenced by Tyre. Now, to the north of the Phoenician coastline, the city of Sidon will be affected. The city of Sidon mothered the city of Tyre. She was the source of the city of Tyre. And so we read, "Be silent, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon. Your messengers crossed the sea." So Sidon is going to be affected. Here is Tyre, and just north of Tyre is the mother city of Sidon on the coast. So to the north, the Phoenician coastline is stilled. To the south, Egypt is stilled. "And we're on many waters. Your ships were on many waters. The grain of the Nile, the harvest of the river was her revenue. And she was the market of the nations." So to the south, Egypt is going to be affected by the destruction of Tyre. And Egypt was a key customer of Tyre. Egypt produced grain for world trade and exported it. And they exported it on Tyrrhenian ships. And so Tyre was called the marketplace of the nations. And Sidon, therefore, will feel shame when Tyre is destroyed in verse 4. "Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I have neither travailed nor given birth. I have neither brought up young men or reared virgins." So again, as I said earlier, Sidon mothered Tyre and then was surpassed by Tyre. Tyre became greater than Sidon. But now there will be so little left of Tyre that the sea denies it ever existed. The sea is personified here. The sea is given a voice and says, "I don't know anything about Tyre. I have no idea. And, you know, she just didn't exist." Well, there's so little left of it that nobody wants to claim any relationship with Tyre, not even the sea. And Egypt feels the pain of Tyre's demise in verse 5. "When the report reaches Egypt, they will be in anguish at the report of Tyre." And there's three reasons why Egypt will be in anguish. First of all, Tyre provided ships to transport the Egyptian grain. And secondly, Tyre was the wholesaler of the Egyptian grain sales. She was the market of the nations. But thirdly, Tyre blocked invading armies. If Tyre falls, Egypt will be invaded. So when armies come from the north, they have to take Tyre, they have to take Sidon, so that their supply lines will not be cut, and so that they won't be attacked from the rear, and that gives them free hand. Once they take the coast, once they destroy Tyre, they will have free hand to move into Egypt, because Tyre was a key city blocking their way. So Egypt is in fear as well. So the survivors of Tyre are urged to seek refuge in the colonies. Verse 6, pass over to Tarshish, wail, O inhabitants of the coastland. So she who established colonies is now seeking refuge in them. And there were three or four Phoenician colonies named Tarshish. We don't know exactly how many, but at least three. So here we see a map, a modern map of Sidon and Tyre, located in the modern city of Lebanon. And the inhabitants of Tyre are told, flee, flee to Tarshish, find safety across the sea. And as she is destroyed, Tyre is also mocked, taunted in verse 7. Is this your jubilant city, whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize different places? So is this the jubilant city? That's mockery. That's mockery. She has now been destroyed. Is this a city of antiquity? And Tyre was a very, very old city. She was 2,300 years old in Isaiah's day. Is this the city whose feet was always on the move to create colonies? Yes, it was. This prominent city has now ceased to exist. This city had a type A type of personality, always on the move, always looking for some way to make a profit. And the cause for Tyre's destruction is God himself. So the question would be raised, who brought about, who purposed this destruction of this mighty city? And that comes out in verse 8. Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored of the earth? You know, Tyre was so powerful on the coast of the Phoenician, on the Phoenician coast there, that she was the bestower of crowns. What this refers to is that Tyre created colonies ruled by kings. They would create colonies, they would set up puppet kings in those colonies, kings who owed their allegiance to Tyre. So they expanded their influence and power out through these colonies. So Tyre's merchants were princes. They were not commoners. And Tyre's traffickers were the big men of the world. They were the big men of the day. Tyre was the Wall Street of the period. She was the big, powerful commerce center of the period. So who has purposed this? Verse 9, the Lord of hosts has planned it, to defile the pride of all beauty, to despise all the honored of the earth. So the Lord has done this in order to pollute pride, to bring down glory, and to bring into contempt the honorable ones of the earth. This would be a reference to the proud, proud businessmen who lived in Tyre and who set up these colonies and who grew incredibly rich. So now the result is, one of the results is that the colonies become independent in verse 10. Overflow your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. That's a reference to a colony. There is no more restraint. So the colonies are free to seek commerce anywhere they want. They're free to go anywhere they want. Like the flooding of the Nile River, just spread out all over the place. Do your own thing as far as commerce is concerned. You are no longer beholden to Tyre. You are no longer under the dependence upon Tyre. You're independent. And all of this is under the unshakable purpose of God. Verse 11, he has stretched his hand out over the sea. He has made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Canaan to demolish its strongholds. So God is the commander of the destroying army. And there'll be no rest for Sidon, even when Tyre is gone. Verse 12, he has said, you shall exult no more, O crushed virgin daughter of Sidon. Arise, pass over to Cyprus. Even there you will find no rest. So again, Sidon was Tyre's mother city. It's only about 25 miles north. It's also effective. And here is our map of Tyre and Sidon again. And the survivors are urged to flee to Cyprus. Cyprus is this island just to the north and west of Sidon. And so the survivors are urged, find safety across the ocean. Find safety across the Mediterranean Sea. Go to Cyprus. You have nothing left for you in Sidon. And the means of this destruction is brought out in verse 13. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans. This is the people which was not. Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. They erected their siege towers. They stripped its palaces. They made it a ruin. So the means for destroying Tyre are the Babylonians. Now, up to Isaiah's day, there had been two Babylonian empires. The first Babylonian empire ruled, or existed, I should say, from 2800 to 745 BC. It was then destroyed and ruled by Assyria from 745 to 626 BC. Now, this is why that little explanatory note has been put in the verse that we just read, verse 13. The little note says, "This is the people which was not," referring to Babylon, which had been in existence and now had been destroyed, or nor have been come under Assyrian domination. And that's the next point of the insert. Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. Assyria wanted the first Babylonian empire snuffed out. But while they did dominate the area of Babylon for a while, Babylon came back. The second Babylonian empire existed from 626 to 539 BC. Babylon regained power and overthrew Assyria just after Isaiah's day, just after Isaiah's time. The Babylon mentioned in Isaiah 23:13 is the second Babylonian empire rising from Assyrian dominance. They are beginning to throw off the Assyrian yoke. Now, the second Babylonian empire was destroyed by Medo-Persia in 539 BC. But that's not the end of the Babylonian empire. Babylon will rise again. There'll be a third Babylonian empire. The city of Babylon will rise again as the political, economic, and religious capital of the planet during the Antichrist's worldwide government, during the time of the Roman Empire. So Babylon is not finished yet. So the Babylon of the second Babylonian Empire is the Babylon that is referenced here. This is the Babylon that will destroy Tyre, the second Babylonian Empire. They'll set up siege towers, they'll destroy the palace, and Tyre will be ruined. And so we come in verse 14 to the conclusion, a repetition of verse 1. "Wail, O ships of Tarshish, for your stronghold is destroyed." But Tyre is not done either. Tyre is going to be destroyed and brought down by the Babylonians, but that's not her end. There'll be a restoration of Tyre after 70 years, which is revealed to us in verse 15. Tyre will rise again. Now, in that day, Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years, like the days of one king. At the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre as the song of the harlot. So in that day, this is the day of Tyre's destruction by Babylon, Tyre will be insignificant. In that day, Tyre will be insignificant for 70 years, kind of parallel to the nation of Israel. Just like the Jewish nation, Israel was exiled for 70 years to Babylon, but Tyre will be desolate for the 70 years of the Babylonian Empire. And then Tyre will begin to rise again, like the song of the harlot. And the picture here is of an old harlot forced to ply her trade because of hunger. So she goes out into the streets to attract her former customers and begin her business again. The song of the harlot is brought out in verse 16. "Take your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot. Pluck the strings skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered." So that's a picture of Tyre rising out of obscurity. So the point of the song is that after 70 years, Tyre will again play a part as a harlot in world trade. Verse 17. "It will come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. And then she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms on the face of the earth." Now, most of this trade, this commerce, will be corrupting. And yet, some of the merchandising will become holy in verse 18. "Her grain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. It will not be stored up or hoarded, but her grain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord." So some of this merchandise will be for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord. That would be Israel. Some of this merchandise will be used in Israel. And this is fulfilled when Tyre supplied material for the rebuilding of the temple in Ezra 3, chapter 3. We start in Ezra chapter 3, verse 2, and we learn that Yeshua, the son of Jehozadak, and his brothers, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brothers arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it. as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So the exiles, the exiles return to Israel, and they have a strong, strong passion to rebuild the temple or start the sacrificial system. So here in verse 2, that begins. They build the altar to start the sacrificial system. Verse 6. Let's jump down to verse 6 now. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. So the worship of the Lord begins, but the foundation of the temple of the Lord has not been laid. There's no temple yet, but they've begun the sacrificial system. Then they gave money to the masons and the carpenters and food and drink and oil to the Sidonians and to the Tyrenians. There they are. There's Tyre. People living in Tyre, the merchants of Tyre. Why did they give them money and food and drink and all that? To pay them so that they could bring cedar wood from Lebanon to the sea at Joppa, according to the permission they had from Cyrus, king of Persia. So they strike up a business deal with the Tyrenians for the supplies that they need. And now in the second year of their coming to the house of God in Jerusalem, in the second month, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Jehozadak, and the rest of their brothers, and the priests, and the Levites, and all who came from the captivity to Jerusalem, these are all the exiles, began the work and appointed the Levites from 20 years and older to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. So the temple now begins to be erected. And what's being used is material brought to the returnees by Tyre, bought and paid for from Tyre. Okay, let's move on to the next major segment of Isaiah. We're moving on to chapter 24, verse 1 through chapter 27, verse 13. This section is often called the little apocalypse of Isaiah, because much that is found in Revelation is found in these four chapters. And the structure of these chapters is the same as the book of Revelation. So Revelation is really an expansion on this information here, these four chapters. So we were in the near future with the destruction of Tyre. Now we move to the tribulation period in verses 1 through 20. We're in the tribulation period, and we get a look at the worldwide judgment of God upon the earth, beginning in verse 1. Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters all its inhabitants. So the source of this destruction and disaster is the Lord himself. And the results, the earth is made empty and waste. The surface of the earth is distorted. The King James and the ASV say it turns it upside down. Probably a better translation would be distorts its surface. In other words, there's going to be all kinds of massive earthquakes, geological and geographical changes on the surface of the earth during the tribulation period. And the result, the inhabitants of the earth are scattered. These are the survivors. They flee the disasters. There's not many places to flee when the whole earth is experiencing earthquakes and great movements of the tectonic plates. And these disasters are universal upon mankind. Verse 2, and the people will be like the priest, and the servant like his master, and the maid like her mistress, the buyer like the seller, the lender like the borrower, the creditor like the debtor. See, these disasters are going to obliterate all class distinctions. Everybody's going to be lowered to the same plane. Six pairs of opposites are brought here. The first three contrasts are the social classes, people and priest, servant and master, mistress and maid. And then the second group of three contrasts is the economic classes, buyer and seller, creditor and debtor, taker of interest, giver of interest. Everybody is now leveled down to the same plane. So that's the effects on humanity. It's universal. Everybody is struggling through these disasters. And in verses 3 and 4, the effects upon the earth are revealed. The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled. For the Lord has spoken this word. The earth mourns and withers. The world fades and withers. The exalted of the people of the earth fade away. So there's a tremendous emphasis in the literal Hebrew. If you translated it kind of literally, you'd probably be translated this way. Emptied. There will be emptied the earth. Spoiled. It will be spoiled. The repetition is a way to communicate emphasis in Hebrew. And it's certain to happen. The certainty of it is emphasized because the Lord has spoken this word. So the earth mourns and fades away. And in that verse, verse 4, you find the Hebrew term tevel. The tevel refers to the inhabited earth, the people. And so the surface of the earth languishes and fades away. So do the lofty people. The upper class languishes as well. They suffer under this judgment. And so everybody, again, is reduced to the same level of struggle and suffering. And the cause of the judgment, the reason why this judgment is brought upon the earth, first reason is the pollution of earth by man in verse 5. The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants. And I would assume that this is probably both spiritual, moral pollution, as well as physical pollution. You know, mankind is the planet's steward, and we have not done a great job of stewarding this planet. So, moral, spiritual pollution, and physical pollution. And the means is the violation of the Noahic covenant in verse 5. For they transgressed laws, they violated statutes, they broke the everlasting covenant. And that would be a strong emphasis on moral pollution. Now, this covenant is a covenant with mankind in general. It's an everlasting covenant. It's explained in Genesis 9, verses 1 through 17. So let's take it a little aside right now and look at the seven basic stipulations of the Noahic covenant, the basic precepts of the Noahic covenant in Genesis chapter 9. Number one, God gives the command to mankind to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth after the Noahic flood that emptied the earth of human inhabitants and animal life. Secondly, mankind is given authority over the animal kingdom. That authority is granted to mankind, but fear of man is also given to the animals. That's because vegetable and animal food are permitted for mankind. So the fear of man given to the animals is to help them survive and make it harder for mankind to hunt them down for food. So authority over the animal and kingdom is granted, and so now vegetables and animal food is permitted to man. Before the Noahic flood, everyone was a vegetarian. Even though we're allowed to eat animals, the flesh of animals, stipulation number 4 states that eating and drinking blood is forbidden. Blood is every animal life is blood driven. So the life of the creature is in the blood, and so it is to be respected. It is not to be treated as common. So eating or drinking blood is forbidden. Fifthly, capital punishment for homicide is instituted. That's among mankind. Sixthly, never again, God says, never again will he destroy the world through a flood. So never again will there be a worldwide flood. And seventhly, the token of this covenant is the rainbow. This is with the cloud cover dispersing. This is the first time that rainbows appeared in the clouds. So that is a basic outline of the Noahic covenant. So violation of all or some of these areas causes the defiling of the earth, and therefore the curse has devoured the earth in verse 6. Therefore a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. So this is the consequences for disobedience to the Noahic covenant. And as a result, the inhabitants of the earth are burnt, according to verse 6 as well. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. Now, as I said, under the Noahic covenant, there will be no more destruction of humanity by water. So when the next destruction comes, when the next judgment comes, it will be by fire. And many of the judgments in the tribulation are fire judgments. And the result, few men are left. And with all this destruction and disaster, all sources of joy and gladness are cut off from mankind. Verse 7. The new wine mourns, the vine decays, all merry-hearted, all the merry-hearted sigh. So wine is removed. And in verse 8, music is removed. The gaiety of tambourines ceases. The noise of revelers stops. The gaiety of the harp ceases. And whatever is left becomes bitter. All joy goes out of life. And I think we can understand why. They do not drink wine with song. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. There's no solace. It's a dark, dark time for planet Earth and the survivors. An example of all this is the stricken city of Babylon in verses 10 through 12. It's called the city of chaos in verse 10. The city of chaos is broken down. Every house is shut down so that none may enter. Now, some commentators feel that this is a reference to Jerusalem. Others feel it's a reference to Babylon. Now, we feel that it's a reference to Babylon because of the context. God is dealing with the world in general here. He's not dealing with Israel specifically. And in addition, Babylon will be the capital city of the world at this point in time in history. It'll be the Antichrist's economic, political, and religious capital. And so this city is in chaos. It's inaccessible. Its doors are blocked by the ruins of the city. Now, in verse 7, wine and song had been removed from the world. Now, this is stated that this is specifically removed from this city. Verse 11, there's an outcry in the streets concerning the wine. All joy turns to gloom. The gaiety of the earth is banished. So wine and song are removed. And then in verse 12, the city is a desolation. Desolation is left in the city. And in the second part of verse 12, the gate is battered to ruins. In other words, the city is indefensible. It's been overrun and destroyed. And so this example of the city of chaos is now applied in verse 13. For thus it will be in the midst of the earth. It's applied to all the earth among the peoples. It's applied to the entire world and all the people that have survived. As the shaking of an olive tree, as the gleanings when the grape harvest is over. So what is true of this city, the city of chaos, Babylon, will become true worldwide. This is true due to the massive destruction of humanity and the planet during the tribulation. Only a remnant will be left. So again, it's a very dark, deep, dark, black time for the survivors of these judgments. But suddenly, in the midst of this massive worldwide darkness and judgment, comes the worldwide glorification of God's name in verses 14 through 16. Verse 14, they raise their voices, they shout for joy. They cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord. So this cry is heard first from the west. That's where the shouting comes from, the west. And the reason is because of the majesty of the Lord. And then it's heard from the east in verse 15. Therefore glorify the Lord in the east, the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, in the coastlands of the sea. And not only is it heard, it is glorification heard in the west and in the east, but soon it's heard in the uttermost parts of the earth in verse 16. From the ends of the earth we hear songs, glory to the righteous one. So there's singing of songs. Glory to the righteous ones. This is God is being praised here. Now, what is going on? Well, we can understand what's going on if we look to the book of Revelation. Revelation is based on this structure. In Revelation 6, well, let's take a look at the structure of Revelation 6 through 9. In Revelation 6, we have the seal judgments bringing this disaster upon the earth. And in Revelation 8 and 9, we have the trumpet judgments bringing more disaster upon the earth. But in between these two, we have chapter 7, which is an interlude of praise in the midst of judgment. In verses 1 through 8, God is praised because 144,000 Jewish evangelists go out and preach. They preach to the tribulation survivors. And then in verses 9 through 17, we see that myriads of Gentiles are reached, are saved by the ministry of the Jewish evangelists. They preach, the Gentiles are reached. And so great glory goes up to the Lord and great praise goes up to the Lord from these survivors. So They're singing songs, and which the rest of the world is not doing. They're not doing. However, well, let's take a look here at the, let's review before we move on to verse, the second part of verse 16. Let's review the chronology of the tribulation. Make sure we have a good handle on that. The tribulation period is 7 years in length, the full 7 years. It's broken down into two halves, the first half and a second half. And the two halves are broken down into quarters, first, second, third, and fourth quarter. Now, we're looking right now at only the first half of the tribulation, the first 3.5 years, the first quarter and the second quarter. It's in the first quarter that the seven seal judgments occur, Revelation chapter 6, bringing on this time of devastation. It's in the middle, between the first and second quarter, we have this interlude of praise. That's Revelation chapter 7. That's what we're reading about here in the book of Isaiah. And then, when we enter the second quarter, the seven trumpet judgments begin in verses 8 through 11. So let's back off a little bit. Now we see the full 7 years. After the second quarter, we come to the middle of the tribulation, and there are a number of mid-tribulation events and announcements in Revelation 10 through 14 and 17. Now we're looking at the second half of the tribulation, the second 3.5 years, the third and fourth quarter. And it's in the third and fourth quarter that the seven bowl judgments are poured out upon the earth. And finally, the campaign of Armageddon comes at the end of the tribulation period and the second coming in Revelation 18 and 19. So that is the chronology of the tribulation. Here is the full chart. You can see all the events laid out on one page there. If you'd like to copy that down, this is the chronology of the tribulation. So we see that in the middle, then, of verse 16, he returns to the judgment. Remember, there's this the judgment prior to this interlude of praise in chapter 6 of Revelation, then the interlude of praise, which we're looking at here in Isaiah 24, and then in chapters 8 and 9, the judgments begin again. He returns to the fact that judgment will befall the earth. Isaiah says, "But I say, woe is me, woe to me, alas for me. The treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously." So for the rest of the earth, for those who don't come to trust the Lord in the tribulation period, judgment will not be alleviated. And so Isaiah cries, "Woe is me." Again, we see Isaiah's tender heart burdened by the revelation that he has received from God. This judgment is inescapable. Verse 17. Terror and pit and snare confront you, O inhabitant of the earth. So we have three elements are described: terror, pit, and snare. They emphasize the inescapability of the judgment in verse 18. Then it will be that he who flees the report of disaster, that's the terror, will fall into the pit. That's a reference to the pit. And he who climbs out of the pit will be caught in the snare. Terror, pit, and snare. They emphasize the inescapable nature of the judgment. Well, I'm just about out of time right now. Only have another minute or two left. And we have a few more verses in chapter 24 to cover. I think I'm better stop here. I'll stop here. We'll pick it up in the middle of verse 18. In the middle of verse 18, there'll be an allusion to the Noahic flood, pointing out the totality of the destruction. So let's pick it up next session in the middle of verse 18. And we'll finish up chapter 24 and move on. All right. Well, thanks for being our students. Thank you for being part of us at this session. We'll see you next session as we go through the book of Isaiah. Lehi Tra'ot.